I will. Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Members of the committee, privileged to be here to talk about our perspectives on job creation and tell you a little bit about NRI. I'm Mike Lawlich. I'm the director of the Natural Resources Research Institute at the University of Minnesota Duluth. My colleagues are Don Fosnick, who's in charge of applied research and technology development, and Pam Sarvala, who is in charge of our development from a business perspective, business development. We're going to be talking today about job creation based on our experience, based on the fact that all three of us have had a rather lengthy industrial career before joining the university. But I'm going to tell you up front, and there are no magic bullets, at least from my perspective. So we don't have all the solutions, but I do think we have some interesting insights. Our mission is to foster economic development of Minnesota's natural resources in an environmentally sensitive manner to promote private sector employment. That's a mouthful. And early on, so that we could understand what the heck we were about, we developed three goals. The first of these is near-term economic development. And by that I mean roll up our sleeves, help entrepreneurs, small companies, larger companies if they need it, use our business talent, use our scientific engineering talents, and see whether we can help them develop new products, improve processing, whatever, in a relatively short-term basis. A couple weeks, a couple years, it doesn't really matter. Very important part of what we do. And we'll talk about that a little bit more. Our second goal is the applied research and development of products, processes, services for Minnesota's future. And Don will spend a little bit of time talking about that. But right up front, I just want to point out that if you're going to do this sort of thing, you need to develop your infrastructure, you need the capability, the laboratories, the tools. You have to have vision for where you're going and strategy. Some of these things take time. They take some early seed money, sometimes concept development, and then you bring in your business associates. The sooner we can bring in business partners, good business partners, whether they're entrepreneurs, small businesses, or larger businesses, the better we are, because we can't do the job creation by ourselves. And then our third goal is to provide the knowledge base that we need. As we all know today in particular, environmental and economic decisions are lockstep together. So the better we know our area and the impacts of what we're doing, the better our decisions and the less trouble we get into in the future. Just by a quick way of background summary on NRI, we were an outgrowth of the down economy in the late 70s, early 80s. Steel industry was down, taconite industry was down. And that was the impetus to start an applied research institute focused on economic development, job creation. Been in operation now about 25 years. We employ typically 130 to 200 employees. In the summer, we get really active. Or we call it our summer field season. We're out there as geologists or biologists or whatever. Last summer, we employed over 30 students, undergraduates to graduates, on a full-time basis. So our census is a little bit. And I think it's important to note that our engine is a state special, about $3 million right now. And we leverage that, that in the last 4 or 5 years, our annual expenditures out of the institute have varied between $12 million and $16 million a year. We get our matching support federally, $2 to $6 million. From industry, we have a large industry connection, and I would note that I'm only talking in the $2 to $4 million, the money that comes through us. Quite frequently, when we do pilot scale efforts in particular, those industries spend a lot in their plants on the infrastructure development and the experiments, and therefore, but it doesn't come through my budget, so I don't track that. We do work for the state, LCCMR, DNR, and groups like that. And then And Representative Rukavina is well aware, we have a foundation account directed on mineral development, the permanent university fund. I was told specifically that you were interested in leveraging federal resources. And I just want to show you that, and don't worry about the projects here, but we can and do work cooperatively with federal agencies and groups. I've got it bolded here. I want to point out that state match is often required. But in general, we've had a relatively successful track record in the last number of years. We've had funding from the U.S. Economic Development Agency, EDA, the Department of Energy, Department of Transportation, Corps of Engineers, U.S. Department of Agriculture, U.S. Forest Service, and particularly we have a very good working relationship with the U.S. Forest Service, Forest Products Laboratory in Madison, National Science Foundation, EPA, particularly on environmentally oriented subjects, and a couple of the smaller programs. We'd like to be doing more. BAM has been working on SBIR grants. Each agency, all 11 of them, I believe, have about 2% of their budget for early stage research and then second stage research to help small companies in conjunction with university groups to develop their business ideas. And at the same time, we have under us the UMD Center for Economic Development jointly with the business school and the College of Science and Engineering, and it has the federally sponsored and state sponsored small business development centers. Typically in a year's time, dealing with really small clients, they will work with about 600 clients. Out of that might come 75 financial plans and procurement for loans or whatever for support from banks. I think the total in about 2008 was like about $19 million. About 400 jobs by independent survey will result from this. $2 million in state taxes from those 400 jobs, and maybe an employee employment of about wages of about $12 million. So you can see how we leverage our resources. And I'm going to go back to this personal bias editorial comment. I've been coming before this committee or its predecessors for quite a long time now, and after 25 years, I just want to say that. And thank, I guess, the state for the tremendous investment. I think the state should be proud of itself. You should be proud of yourself in an organization like NRI. Just think of the facilities now that we have as tools. Our laboratory, the Coleraine Mineral Laboratories, which used to be the U.S. Steel Research Laboratories, worldwide renowned. All the equipment we've been able to gather over a period of time, if you get a grant from the federal government and a particular piece of equipment can be sometimes included in that grant, then it's available for the next customer that came along. But even more importantly, the experience that we have gotten as employees. Quite honestly, not everything we do works, but we get smarter, I hope, with time, so we have a good sense of what does work. So I'm really, really saying with respect to economic development, job creation, it's probably not a marathon, but it is a steady and dedicated effort going forward. I want to back up now a little bit because I was asked to talk about job creation strategies, and I'm not an economist or anything like that, but whatever. In my mind, though, you can characterize what we hear about a lot in terms of what is job creation all about. Well, you know, with the stimulus and so forth and so on, we see now and a lot of job creating efforts are really basically investing in infrastructure, new roads, improvements to schools and so forth. These things have a short-term economic benefit, and maybe longer if the roads and schools lead to a better society and economy. For example, I just read an article where $1 million invested in our roads results in 14 jobs building the roads and supplying the materials and so forth, and then another 6 support jobs in terms of induced jobs, you know, the restaurants and whatever that is needed that kind of feeds the economy. But the question is, how much money can you put in and how long can you sustain these sorts of things? The second area that I would categorize is job creation programs, such as JobZ or grants to or loans to businesses, maybe tax reductions and so forth. Anything that'll help a company at a key point in time, and this can be helpful. But it's incomplete. You know, there are so many factors that determine the success of a business. They're technical, they're business, they're strategic. One of the things that we've done, and you'll see in our examples, we get clients, and we work with clients, and we've stuck with some of these clients for 20 years. You know, and it's a continual evolvement. And then the other thing, of course, in terms of job creation, we hear a lot about is recruiting from elsewhere. We used to call it smokestack chasing. I guess we still probably do. We offer packages and incentives, and then we try to convince companies to locate in a region or an area because we have certain attributes that they need. Not easy, and of course we're doing it. Everybody's doing this kind of a push-pull thing. Just recently now in Duluth, there's excitement because we've gone from 10 applicants to 2 applicants for a major wind business that would benefit both Duluth and the Iron Range in terms of a projected 1,500 jobs. Let's see what happens, but that can also be, in some instances, useful economic development. Characteristics we'll be talking about here are ours, kind of our model, applied research and technology development model with business assistance, is trying to grow business. And as I indicated earlier, we offer technical and business development assistance, particularly on a shorter term basis with clients. And the key is there to find the qualified clients. There are a lot of well-meaning people, pretenders to the throne, and there are some two-headed monsters out there that will come in and say, we're going to do this and we're going to do that. So we have to kind of sort through those things. And then, as Don will be talking about, we really want to focus on long-term development. We want to have a vision, we've developed strategies, and we are in the process of working through these things. And again, some pre-preparation might be needed before we engage business.
Mike, can I interrupt you just for a second? Now that I have a quorum, I call the meeting to order, and Representative Beinert would move to approve the minutes of the January 26th and February 9th meeting.
So moved.
Thank you. You've read through them, I'm sure. All those in favor signify by saying, are there any additions or corrections? Not all those in favor say aye. 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 Opposed, same side. Mr. Lalich, I had hoped we could hear some things that are, you know, where you're actually doing
some
working
work
with businesses, some of the things you've created.
My next step, Tom.
Okay, so if we could get going, you know,
yeah,
and get to that today. Part. Some of the things you're doing maybe at the Coleraine Lab and what?
Right.
Some of the, from wood products to mineral products, what you've come up with.
Right.
So go ahead.
We'll do that. And I want to just point out here that you need a niche if you're going to be successful. You need a reason, an area. You know, if you say you're biotechnology, that's a huge, everybody's into it, but what area within biotechnology? We're fortunate in this state, fortunate in northeastern Minnesota. We've got the natural resources. And I just want to point out really quickly that of the economic sectors, natural resource sectors in northeastern Minnesota are over 50% of the economy. Mining a full third, forestry under duress but still major, tourism. And going to a little bit to what Thomas, Representative Ruth Provena is talking about, and longer term visions, I wanted to point out that just looking at the mining sector, now there are about 11,000 jobs, 11,600 jobs as a baseline, and about 10,000 of those are in the iron, and another 14 are non-ferrous. But with the projects that are online in northeastern Minnesota, the copper nickel developments that we have worked on hand in hand with the exploration companies through our economic geology group that we established as we were established, there is a potential to basically double that employment and output to the economy. And it builds on jobs. There are maybe 3,600 primary jobs in the taconite companies, but all the support jobs in an economy lead to it. So you've got to focus on the primary. Okay, let's talk near-term economic development, the short-term stuff. I've got a couple of examples. We just got a lot of things going on, but I just wanted to give you a flavor. Several years ago, we started working, well, we've been working with Hillwood Products in Cook, Minnesota for a long time, but things were getting tough for these folks. They make the joinery biscuits and dowels that go into the constructions of windows and doors and things like that, but the Chinese are just incessantly, they're so competitive. Began to look at other options for them. We introduced a cutting technology that allowed you to cut composites very thinly. It's called frame saw technology. From Germany, we picked this up. And then we worked with it. We first started working on moldings for these curved doors and things like that. In the end analysis, we worked on developing them a laminated flooring composite material. I don't know, Don, you might want to just pass that on. But they've not only stabilized their business, they've grown their business, and they are holding their own during this down economy. And there are a lot of companies that, of course, are not. Here's another example that I like, only in that it tells you how this thing can happen. Two fellows came to us in the early 90s and said, hey, we would like to use pressure and overlays and develop cabinetry and so forth and so on. And we started working with them. They brought in an old press. We found money at that time through the Minnesota technology to match their efforts, and we computerized it. Long story short, over that period of time, they've grown to over 550 employees. I think they're down a little bit now in the economy. I looked at their website, at 500 yesterday, and their principal operations are in Fergus Falls. They're a St. Paul headquartered company. As soon as they got to a point where they had enough millions of dollars of sales, they have kept a research project ongoing to improve their products and their line for about 20 years now.
Do they do that with you, Mr. Lawley?
They do that with
They
our
keep using you as a researcher?
Yes, they do. Yeah.
Did you hear that, Representative Nornes? You're in your district.
Do that.
Yes.
We thank them a lot.
Yes.
Well, they're just, if we had more partners like those folks, we could do a lot more. That's the key. Good businesses.
Go ahead, Representative.
So when you said you found this technology and you brought it to the provided the technology and then they were the experimenters that figured out how to use this technology and actually market it
No, they came in with the idea that they had heard something about this and we've got a press here. Shouldn't we be able to do something with it? And we working with them. Developed it in our laboratories, and our laboratories have basically become their research laboratories.
Made a lot of the prototypes.
Yeah, a lot of prototypes. You go into Target, I hate to admit this, so you see those ugly orange counters? Those first counters were made at NRI, and that's this company's deal. What can I say? Anyway, on to other things. And this is just how things happen. We started working with a small company in Duluth that were making
skateboard parks
for municipalities, in places like that. And we worked on materials. We developed composite materials with them that would work. And at the time, we had a National Science Foundation grant. One of our scientists was doing manufacturing efficiency, lean manufacturing. They looked at those guys and said, there is no way you can run this business with all this waste product. Kind of looked at each other and said, what can we do with all this waste? Well, we can make breadboards. They've sold the skateboard company. They sell $8 million of these creative little breadboards that are floating around. They've now gone, with our help, to manufacturing outdoor Adirondack furniture from recycled materials, milk cartons. And they charge about $600 plus for that doggone little chair. And they get it. Not from me, but they get it. And it's a growing company in Duluth. Here's another one we developed with an entrepreneur that had to get water samples. They had to fly in an airplane, could never get enough, bad weather. We developed a solar-powered buoy system, and we developed optical sensors. We hired a scientist that would go up and down the water column. And They operated as a prize corporation. They kind of got out of the buoys. They got more into optical sensors. They had about 25 people in Duluth. A year or so ago, they were bought out by Ecolab. The fellow that's shown there is one of our former scientists. He's now their vice president for that Ecolab division. At the time, they were going to grow to about 100 employees in Duluth. I'm sure that whatever plans they have been kind of put on the back burner during this economy. But it's a good example of how things can happen and how environmental things can be put into jobs. One that's getting some actually national attention right now is our work with Goodwill Industries on mattresses. Can you imagine the problem with landfilling old mattresses because they were unusable? What we've done now is worked with those folks to take the components apart and find products for each and every component. A real problem, for this example, was the springs. Can you imagine a pile of springs? What do you do to compact springs? Kapoink, kapoink. We ended up working on the outside and ended up with the ability to do that. These springs are now being charged into foundries to make new metal. You've got cotton product that goes into fuel filters, stormwater filters. You've got bedding materials for
landscaping.
Goodwill is employing people in Duluth doing this, and there's another effort going on in Minneapolis. And it's just starting, and I think it's going to grow.
And it collects the mattresses from all over the Iron Range, so it's bringing a lot of resources in that would otherwise be in the landfills.
They don't have old mattresses in Duluth, or what?
But we got those too.
Okay.
But we're trying to chew them all up.
Okay, now I'm going to give Don a little chance here to talk about some of the more strategic, longer-term things that we've been working on.
So I'm going to take you through...
Don, why don't you just introduce yourself?
I'm Don Posnock. I'm the director for the Center for Applied Research and Technology Development. I'm going to lead you through a little bit longer-term horizon of projects that we've undertaken, and I'm going to focus on what we've done with housing concepts, iron ore, as well as the non-ferrous development. And first, the housing concept. Back in about 2002, we started looking at what was going on from an emergency management standpoint of trying to house people after they've had a very bad situation, whether it's Hurricane Katrina, the flooding we have in the northwest part of the state, or even tornado-type situations. What we found was they typically would have to haul in these trailers from FEMA, and we thought there was a better solution to that. So we began work looking at technologies again abroad. We started with a Japanese technology. That technology partner actually came to Minnesota, but things didn't work out for them for a variety of reasons. But we learned a lot from them. And then we focused on improved fastener and manufacturing practices for wood panels that could be easily assembled into a structure. And we actually built the first prototype back in about 2006. Ended up being sold for a small cabin on a bid basis, and the guy hauled it away. The key concept here is you can pack all the panels into a big box and haul it to where you want. Well, over that course of time, from 2006 to the current, we refined the overall concepts into a pretty sophisticated and elegant design, and we brought in collaborators who included an architect, an engineering firm, and a manufacturing entity in the Duluth area. And we've now made a full-size prototype that's going to be under evaluation by FEMA in March. And FEMA has a very elaborate process for actually approving any potential house of this type that would be then saleable through the federal network. And so in March, we should have the inspection. The basic concept is to pack all the components into one half the house, haul that house to the site, and then very quickly erect it. I'm going to walk you through, and in the end, you get this house on my left. That is the finished product. And it allows you to incorporate some really nice features that go well beyond what you'd anticipate for a temporary house where you can take it up and down. In fact, the house that we're going to show you, we've actually erected three times and put back in its own box. And it takes you one day to disassemble, and what you're going to see, it took us 6.5 hours to erect this house. So we basically packed the house and we hauled it out by truck. This shows you the package that we bring to the site. We prepared the ground by using some pretty standard moorings. This shows you all the components in the house. So if you ever liked some of the old puzzles, this is a perfect one for that. But you can take all these panels out. You start erecting them. And this is the finished product. And if you look inside the house, this actually shows some of that low furniture that Mike talked about. It has a very nice hardwood floor, extremely well insulated. The walls are like R28. The base of the bottom floor is R40 as well as R43 in the ceiling. So very well insulated for Minnesota conditions. Shows you some other views of that particular house. So now we're at the point where we have a small company working with us. We're on the cusp of a full federal approval for continuing that development. And once we get federal approval, we'll be eligible for actually a housing program where they would like you to build, for example, 100 units they can demonstrate on a countrywide basis. Now I want to look at the next thing is iron ore. Let's go wrong way. Basically, back in about 2001, we looked at the iron ore industry and some of the vulnerabilities associated with it. And we put together a three-pronged strategy to work on. One was to make the existing taconite operations as efficient as possible by improving their flow sheets. The other was to look at value-added iron opportunities in terms of converting iron ore to a more iron-rich product. And then to look at the increase in revenue that's potential from mine byproducts. And just to give you a comparison, the iron ores that we have are about 26% iron, and we're competing on a worldwide basis with iron ore that's 65% iron right out of the ground. So we thought that we had to have these other strategies in place. And in fact, with the taconite shipments to the more integrated producers, it's about half the volume of total steel production in the U.S. We wanted to meet the other half as well. So first thing we looked at was plant efficiency. The way we do our work is that we work hand in hand with the plant engineers. They give us issues and problems that need to have some research and development. We do that base at our Kohler and Minerals Laboratory, and we focus on improving their overall flow sheets. That leads us into using advanced modeling techniques and actually simulation at the pilot level in our facilities, and then we demonstrate those things at the mines themselves. But fully integrating our workforce with that of the engineering workforce at these mines. On iron ore development on value-added iron, we started identifying various technologies that could be used for iron ore development to this value-added iron concept basically in about 1999. In fact, we had a series of symposia that we ran at our institute and invited various parties from industry to participate, and we actually had a stakeholder trip over to Japan to look at a lot of technologies back in 2002, and we established a formal program at our Kohler and Minerals Lab at that same time, and we helped to bring over the ITM K3 idea to the Mesabi Nugget entity that eventually got a federal grant with our help. That then allowed us to also continue our development because we got the independent grants, and now we have a project that basically parallels what is being done with the ITM K3 Japanese process that's largely developed out of Minnesota using a large steel end user as a sponsor. And ultimately, I might mention that that end user would like to use Minnesota ore and locate on the Iron Range with a full facility once we've proven out the concept. The way we've conducted this work, we've actually gone from a very small scale to a larger scale, and you can see with the arrows, we ended up with a very large pilot furnace at our facilities. And this partner that we worked with decided to put in a scale-up that's about, if you look back at this last picture, that furnace on the my left again is about 45 feet long and about 10 feet high. Well, we scaled it up to 200 feet long by about 12 feet across and again 16 feet high. So, and that costs about $23 million for the furnace and a lot of development activity that probably we spent about $32 million in this project now. So these are big time developments when you look at some of the natural raw materials. Then we looked at the use of byproducts, because if you can mine it and use it, then it's not so bad to have a lower ore content compared to the others. And we followed up on some work of the Legislative Commission that Tom Rukavina basically chaired for the Twin Cities area, where they're looking at future needs for aggregate, as well as a Blue Ribbon Committee that was led by Tom Reagan. And what it pointed out was the need to look at how do we use this byproduct rock. And so we obtained an Economic Development Association or a development grant from the Department of Commerce, and we examined all aspects of what it would take to take the byproduct rock and create useful products that could be used in significant highway projects. And now we've identified a number of commercial companies that will work with us to try to make this happen. Just to give you some examples, every part of the rock base has been characterized in terms of where it could be utilized. And this just shows the overall type of applications. We can go from armor stone that you put in harbors to very fine friction products that would go onto the top surface of a road to make it very safe. And I'll just show you some examples. For example, they make a lot of tailings material in mining. We can actually segregate that material in different fractions to make a variety of products. Just to show you what can happen, we took tailings material processed by, from Middle Steel, Menorcina Mine, by Ewan Brothers, and we actually put a bridge deck in place with this safety friction material up near Virginia. So these are actual applications. We like to take it from the product all the way through. I think that's one of the things that we can do very well. The Midwest region is in deficit of very high-quality stone, and we've actually had a project where we've taken material from United Taconite down through Duluth all the way down to the Chicago region, and now we're getting inquiries from Chicago contractors on use of this stone because they're in deficit for this high-quality stone. And where they want to focus it is in the top course for highway construction, the wear course, where you need it the most. In the non-ferrous area, we also have had a very long-standing effort to first see what kind of values existed on the Duluth complex, where a lot of these non-ferrous issues basically are coming from. And we established an economic geology group back in the 1984 period. When we started looking at this, we said, you know, the mineral indicators are that we may have a very significant future with some of the non-ferrous developments that potentially could come out, especially if they had
Don,
other values.
Don, second Representative Detmer.
Yes.
Yeah, thank you, Mr. Chairman. And, so you're saying the taconite plant up in Silver Bay, are they going to start reusing the tailings?
No.
I know it's all being shipped out to one location.
Let me clarify that. We have not tried to change anything that are restrictions that were back to the reserve case. There's a demarcation line from East Range to West Range where you don't utilize aggregate materials from the East Range off-site, off the mining site. And that's because there's a change in rock morphology that leads to a lot of issues associated with the potential use of that rock. So all the Western materials, though, do not have that issue. And we have targeted, I think, the five mines on the western side of the range as being potential candidates for basically providing this aggregate material.
Yeah, Representative Detmer, to put that, the geology here, the geography, I should say, the Babbitt mine has a fiber in it that I think you call Minnesota, I don't even know what it is.
Minnesota.
Asbestos-like. But as you move towards LTV's site, it disappears, and I think there's maybe a pit at LTV that had that type of geology. Is that true, Don? And then
yes,
from there over all the way
as you go to the west,
not present.
And that goes back to a couple billion years ago when we had actually there was volcanic rock in Minnesota. And
Larry Haas was there at the time. Where's Larry? Oh, he's not.
And you overheated the rock and changed its overall characteristics in that area. When you're over to the west, that did not happen. Okay, and then we looked at the non-ferrous area as well, and what we've done over a period of probably 25 years is really characterize all the different types of rock that might be associated with these non-ferrous developments. One of our geologists, for example, has looked at over 1.2 million feet of core, And what they do is they actually drill down into the ground and pull out the rock and allows you to look at it. So we do a lot of different things with that economic geology group, and that's to look at the mineral potential of the state, especially in our region. So we'll do detailed mapping for these non-ferrous metals as well as the platinum group metals that are associated with a lot of the deposits. We look at the use of the byproducts there, and then we look at environmental issues that might be associated with extraction of those types of materials. And we usually end up then with projecting what might be in the ground on a three-dimensional basis. That information has been used by a lot of the exploration companies to actually pinpoint where they think they ought to have some rock that could be a useful purpose to them to extract it and reclaim these metal values. So if you look at our longer-term issues, we're a very applied research laboratory. We like to work on tangible projects that will have an impact. We try to balance the economic opportunity with the environmental aspects associated with those practices. And we like to lead to commercialization. So we always sort of have that in mind when we start doing our work. And in many cases, as Mike's shown on the short term, it is related, actually realized in actual opportunities. So I was asked also to point out what we might be doing on the alternative energy front, and I'm just going to highlight a few things here. As you know, there's a lot of different things you can look at, but we're focused in two areas, basically. One is, what do you do to have the right material and prepare it so it can be used in the next stage of processing? So we focused on that end, and we also look for things that would allow us to attack final end uses. We're not working on things that are going to take it and put a big process in there to convert the biomass, for example, to liquid fuels. We're looking at what do you have to do to get the biomass ready to convert it for the next processor. And again, we've used these same tenets, practical focus, solutions, scalability, partnership, environmental sensitivities, and to verify the concepts before you move on. In biomass production, we're looking at four different aspects: enhancing productivity, energy crop development, how do you get the residues out of the forest, and how do you pre-treat the biomass. So I'll just show you some pictures. One of the biggest problems you have with biomass is logistics. How do you collect it efficiently, and how do you get it out of a source area to someone who can use it? So we have a lot of things that are looking at gathering that material, consolidating it, drying it, and preparing it. Then we got into energy crops. We're probably the biggest breeder of hybrid poplar in North America. And that is a very fast-growing tree, which we think will be a very viable energy crop. In fact, Verso Paper now has 20,000 acres of that particular material supplying all their fiber needs near Sartell. We think the same thing could be used on marginal lands, marginal farmlands, and, for example, reclaimed tailings basins. We're also looking at ways to enhance the productivity from existing forests, and we've focused on prescribed thinning technologies that allow you to get more out of the forest, maintain a healthier forest, while at the same time getting biomass that you can use. Then we also have gone into some process development and characterization just to pre-treat this material. And what we found is that a lot of people are struggling with the pelletization process. For example, if you want pellets to put in your home fireplace or fire appliance, the wood varies, the agricultural products vary, but a lot of people don't understand how it varies. So we set up a characterization facility at our Coleraine lab to allow us to generate the information that could be used by the public to get a better understanding of what these wood products or agricultural products might mean in a fuel situation. And you can see some of the things that we look at. It just shows you some of the equipment we have. Some pretty advanced technologies that we put in place, and we're using this stuff to now systematically characterize biomass across the state. We've also added a biomass gasification facility because we think this is another tool that can be used to assess how this biomass material can be utilized long term. And as you know, by state mandate, we have to look at ways to hit the renewable energy goals for the state by 2025. And we're looking at ways, for example, to make a bio-coal out of biomass that would be equivalent in energy content and very handleable with the existing integrated or the pulverized coal injection systems that many power plants have, so they can incorporate more and more biomass into their mixes. And a couple other areas that we're working in the renewable energy area. One is, again, we think a big player for the future, and that is how do you make our existing alcohol industry more viable? And we think by reclaiming more fuel values and value-added products from their byproducts, somewhat akin to what we've done in the aggregate area, we think that you can make them more viable and more energy efficient. And so we have a large effort underway where we're taking the dry distillers, grains, and solubles and extracting out diesel fuel as well as some other products that can lead to, for example, advanced jet fuels. That then gives them more revenue to make the existing alcohol plant more viable, and we produce a very high-protein animal feed, which can be used for the farming community. And finally, we're looking at, again, some taconite-based materials, which has some unique properties, because we think we can make very energy-absorbent materials, which can lead to solar thermal applications. So we've actually made a solar thermal cement using taconite-based materials, as well as some nice tiles using a plasma technology that, again, has good energy absorption properties. And just bringing a thing to conclusion, like Mike has indicated, we are, even in this area, actively engaged in looking at things that are focused on potential technology developments that lead to solutions. We collaborate with commercial entities and industrial and academic partnerships, and I think that's one of the things that sets us off. We'd like to get those people involved as early as possible so we can lead to a commercialization effort. And as anyone else, we try to use some of this early work to lead to larger scale funding, and I think we've been pretty successful at leveraging a lot of our monies beyond what we'd have only from the state itself. Mike, any other comment?
Okay. Pam, are you going to just, you're going to handle the tough questions if we have it.
She's here to back us up.
Yep. You know, I wanted the committee to see the NRI was set up, I guess, during the last financial crisis and bad times back in the early 80s. And they have done, as you said, have seen a number of actually applied projects where jobs have been created. Do you have a number? Do you have an actual number of jobs you've created or estimated or maintained?
I don't like that because we don't create any of these jobs. These companies create the jobs. But we've been involved in thousands of jobs without question, Tom. But that's hard. If you know, we do just little things for companies that help them. But so do I count the jobs? No. But and then sometimes we know we're the brains behind the whole thing. Well, maybe we could count those jobs, but it's hard. We don't do that. We haven't done that.
Okay.
Do you want to point where we're in the state?
Any questions? And any other questions on and on the biomass? Members, I've been looking at a way to look at converting some of our many municipally owned power plants across the state into, and I don't know how to do it yet, and I would appreciate input from everyone, but whether it's regular GO bonds or revenue bonds or whatever, we did make the mandate for 25 and 20, and I think we should look at helping our municipal power plants. They've been working on some of that as far as the availability of the fuels and also what the BTUs are, and I'm going to be coming forward this session with a bill that's going to be looking at.
Mr. Chair, I would make the comment, and that's because I think it's important to understand. We always see comparisons, for example, about what they're doing in Europe and so forth and so on. When you take a look at wood pellets today, for example, with gasoline priced where it is right now, it's very hard to be economically competitive with pellets, even when you're looking at a higher cost fuel like propane. It's going to be the policy that drives the move to move to alternate fuels away from fossil fuels. If we can't, as a country, lose that resolution, or we'll go we've been through the cycle before where we got all excited about these alternate energies, and then economically it doesn't play, and therefore we forget about it till the next crisis. So policy is going to be important.
Well, just as we've mandated a ethanol industry, we mandated a renewable energy industry, and we got to meet the demand. Representative Poppy.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I recognize that you don't want to or aren't able to maybe provide the number of jobs that have been you've been supporting, but I, sitting next to Representative Clark here, we went through your the brochure here and found maybe one woman in all of the pictures of the people here, and so I do have a question about gender. If you know how many businesses that have been female-owned or female-supported businesses that you might have assisted or supported.
Mr. Lawlidge, go ahead.
Yes. Again, I don't have numbers, but I can go back and I can think. I know we helped one female start a housing construction. I know Pam is working with a client now that has a product that's
a warming device for mammography equipment.
So we take on all comers, and as far as employees at NRI and scientists, I guess the one thing that I have seen in the last 25 years is that more and more females are interested in careers in this area. So there are more of these folks, folks like that on our staffs. But we just are looking for the good entrepreneur, and I would say probably the industries that we're in have tended to be male-dominated industries.
But we're changing that.
Yeah.
And our engineering program that's been starting is geared towards. we do have, even though the number of women enrolled is not high, it is higher than the average for. National average for women entering engineering programs. In fact, you've been a little shy about it, but I think you're working with that new engineering program at Mesabi to give them some hands-on experience at the Colerain Lab.
In fact, we've sponsored, Mr. Chairman, we've sponsored, I think, 5 classes now with the engineering program, given the various aspects of mineral experience, ranging from how do you fundamentally understand what's in the rock to actually extracting the metal values from it. And I think our final class actually will be next week.
Representative Welty.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And to the testifiers, I know you said that you don't keep track of jobs, but it's becoming increasingly important as legislators look at the different programs that we have in the state and where to put resources. And I would just encourage you to, even if it's not necessarily scientifically done, I would encourage you to at least, keep track of the jobs, whether it's direct jobs or indirect jobs, and the companies you work with and the number of employees that they have, just so we have an idea of the impact that you are making.
The last time we did an independent survey was in the early to mid-1990s, and at that time, our clients came back and said that we had been instrumental in creating 1,000 jobs, that we had helped them retain over 1,000 jobs. They looked at our projects, and I'm trying to dust off the numbers here now, but about 40% of the projects that we worked on had a new product development aspect. Another 40% were process improvement for their plants. Another 50% had helped them with the resource management and environmental issues. And at the time, when you talk to folks, they say, and you got to be careful with this number, they say, fully as our business matures, it's going to create X number of jobs. Well, some folks are able to do that, some folks don't. When we worked with two entrepreneurs, Northern Contours, in the early 90s, I wouldn't have ever wanted to project that they would be employing 500 people. Now, okay, how many of those jobs do we take credit for? But we did get them started. But I understand your advice. I really do appreciate it.
We've got another example.
No,
of a, I just might mention is the Mesabi Nugget process that Steel Dynamics has. We introduced the concept to them. It went through a lot of development work with Iron Range Resources support, as well as we helped them obtain a federal grant to do that work. So, you know, we planted the seed, but then the seed developed and went independently. Do you lay credits to that? I mean, there was, I think, 1,000 maybe construction jobs associated with that project. But, you know, those are the types of things that gets more difficult because it gets beyond your influence. So you don't want to be falsely claiming, you know, direct jobs either.
I don't know how many jobs is Polymet going to, if they get, or if they're successful, like 600 jobs plus all the construction jobs. I can tell you that at the first, when Polymet first announced himself in a press conference as a company, and that they were going to develop this deposit, to my surprise, at the press conference, they basically said, we would not be here if it weren't for two NRRI geologists, Mark Severson and Steve Howell. They have helped us develop the knowledge of this deposit. They're the most knowledgeable geologists about the Iron Range copper-nickel, and basically they thanked us.
We'll see what happens on that front. But listen, we're going to have to move on because we have Mr. Hemmingson here from the from IREE. And so I want to thank you folks, and I just want to give the committee, thank you so much for coming down from Duluth. I want to give the committee a idea of what we're going to be looking at the next several weeks for the committee. We're going to have the Office of Higher Education here on Thursday to talk about what's happening to the grant program, the governor's budget proposal for all of higher ed, and then Minsky and University will be here to comment on it. Next Tuesday, we're going to have Deed and Dolly in and Commissioner McElroy and Swigum to talk about what the governor's cuts and budget will be, how they'll be affecting them. And on Thursday, we're going to have the legislative auditor in to report on the Minsky, the report they did on Minsky's central office, workforce programs, and the unemployment insurance programs. And on Tuesday, March 2nd, we are going to have the Minnesota Manufacturers Association in here to see if we can, what kind of ideas they have for helping our manufacturing base. And then we may have a number of bills. Representative Obermuller is working on a UI bill. I think Representative Mahoney is working on something. And on the 4th, I want anybody that has any jobs ideas, I'm hoping to have all the jobs bills that may be presented on Thursday, March 4th. And then we'll start in on the budgets for Minsky and the university on March 9th and 11th for them. And then we're going to start hearing bills on the 16th because we got to have a bill out of here by the end of March, I'm told. So any other suggestions and input from committee members? I know I was going to meet with my side of the aisle today, but it didn't work out. So Bob and Sarah, you know, any suggestions you have? We'll get you a copy of what we're proposing here shortly. With that, Dick, welcome to the committee and tell us what IREE is doing with all of that money you get every year.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, members of the committee. I'm Dick Hemmingson with the University of Minnesota's Initiative for Renewable Energy and the Environment, or IREE, as we refer to it. I did leave with you a couple of pieces of information. A lot of detail on specific projects is in the green booklet, and I'll touch on just a few of those today and would encourage you to look through that and or check on our website for additional detail on specific projects. So I think, Mr. Chair, what I'm going to do is go through kind of a few facts and numbers, if you will, about our activities and then pause, kind of see where we're at time-wise as to whether or not to give some project examples or not. And so we'll see how we're doing in that regard. This initiative at the university began actually in 2003, was formally established at that time with the mission that you see there. And I lead with this mission in almost every opportunity I have, because it drives all of the work that we have done to date to promote statewide economic development, sustainable, healthy, and diverse ecosystems, and national energy security. And I should point out that early on in the formation of this initiative, leading with those words, promoting economic development, was purposeful. That being said, all of the commas and all of the ands in that mission statement are important as well. It's economic development and sustainable, healthy, and diverse ecosystems and national energy security. And early on, we established these so-called core values of collaboration, partnerships, leveraging resources, and having an impact. The funding that IRE receives was initially made possible by legislative activity in the 2003 session when funds from the Xcel Energy Renewable Development Fund and saw a portion of the Xcel Energy's annual SIP, or Conservation Improvement Program, funds were directed towards IRE. And then in 2007, there was a transition to the current level of $5 million a year annually from the Xcel Energy Renewable Development Fund. And it is those resources that we use to invest in these programs. Also in 2007, the
Can you give us, you know, what happened to the other $5 million you used to get?
In the sense of there was...
You had a $10 million appropriation.
Yeah, well, that was in the early appropriation. The $10 million was a one-time lump sum, if you will, and that was invested in a series of research projects over time. The initial legislation was $2 million a year in addition to that lump sum payment of 10. And then in 2007, the current funding is a total of $5 million a year now, all from the Renewable Development Fund. In 2007, IRE also became a part of a new program at the university, the Institute on the Environment, and I'm not going to take a lot of time to talk about that today, although I've left you the other white-colored brochure, which is, like IRE, a system-wide initiative, purposefully not part of a single college or department. And IRE is the signature program of this Institute on the Environment with a mission of solving the Earth's biggest problems through cutting-edge research, partnerships, and leadership development. And the three big thematic areas for IONE, and I apologize for all of these acronyms, are energy, food, land, and ecosystems, and fresh water. So I'm going to, just as I said, Mr. Chair, run through some basic facts and numbers, if you will, and see where, how we're doing time-wise as far as whether to take any time to describe some specific projects. We have worked really hard within the University of Minnesota system to reach across the system to have broad involvement, and these are some of the major colleges and units across the University of Minnesota system that have been engaged in these IRE-supported efforts. Perhaps a more appropriate way to think about the reach of this initiative across the university are the various disciplines which we brought to bear on these challenges of renewable energy systems. And just as these problems are comprehensive and complex and require systems approaches, with all due respect to the ecologist or the engineers or the soil scientists or pick the discipline, we need everyone engaged in these efforts to solve the kind of systematic problems, and we've worked pretty hard at that. To date, if you look at the investments that we have made with this funding that was made available by the legislature, we have funded about 170 research projects to date, some smaller seed grant-like, shorter-term projects, some larger, more substantial projects. If you tally up the faculty, their graduate students, the postdocs, the undergraduate students, research scientists, etc., that have been engaged in these IRE-supported efforts, that number stands currently at about 450 researchers across the University of Minnesota system. To date, of the funds we have actually invested, this number has actually gone up a little bit in the last month. I haven't updated about $25 million of these legislatively authorized funds. And our faculty to date have leveraged those IRE investments to the tune of nearly $50 million now from extramural or external sources, mostly federal government research sources like the Department of Energy, the USDA, etc. I wanted to share with you a little bit about some of the appetite for funding that we receive from IRE. We do an internal call for proposals to send us the best research ideas. So in 2009, for example, but we're not, as you can see, very innovative with our terminology, so we have large grants. These are large in terms of the amount of money and over a period of time. We received 31 pre-proposals, invited 20 of those back, and were able to fund 7 of them. So you can see it's a pretty competitive process within the University of Minnesota system. From the outset, we've also had a seed grant program. The intent here is to launch or start some early work to position, hopefully, that research team for subsequent funding opportunities. And again, you can see the appetite for that in terms of the proposals we received in 2009 and the number of projects that we awarded. More recently, we've launched a special opportunity program identifying some strategic opportunities for some added investment. And last year, the three areas that we focused on is our algae program and wastewater as one area. We are just now launching a global renewable energy fellowship program and have made and are continuing to make some targeted investments in next generation ethanol and biofuels as part of this special opportunity program. We are in the midst currently of this year's investment strategy. So we issued a call for proposals and had identified from these resources that have been made available by the legislature $2.5 million to allocate towards the so-called large grant program this year. We received, as you can see, 25 pre-proposals, invited 19 of those back, and we will anticipate funding 4 to 7 of those in the range of $250,000 to $750,000. We started a new program this year aimed at and targeted at early career professionals within the University of Minnesota system. I resisted the effort on the part of some to call them young career grants, so I prefer the term early. But the idea is for people who are in their early years of employment at the University of Minnesota. And we got a really strong response to that. And as you can see, we will anticipate 5 or 6 awards in that category, strong interest in our seed grant program, and some possibilities yet not decided for the so-called special opportunity are this whole idea of waste to energy, or a more sharp focus on conservation and efficient energy utilization. Or with the new funding opportunities available in Washington, perhaps targeting some of these special opportunity funds to better position the university and the state to compete for some of these large DOE-type awards. We also have maintained a matching grant program. And currently, our portfolio in that category of those that are currently active, that is to say they've been awarded by the external funding agency, we have 13 of those projects that we invested about $1.5 million of these IRE resources in. And the faculty who used those funds to apply for these external grants brought in an additional $13 million of these extramural funding sources to the university. And we currently have 14 proposals pending to various funding agencies. I suppose it's safe to say we won't score on all of those, but if we did, that would encumber about $1 million of IRE funds and leverage almost $18 million of external funds. And I want to just talk about this slide for a minute and then, Mr. Chair, pause and see where we're at with respect to time. We spent a lot of time identifying, given the resources and strengths both of the University of Minnesota and the opportunities we see in the state of Minnesota in the upper Midwest, topically, what are the areas that we should focus on? So this is a visual trying to depict that. We have, for obvious reasons, I think, a significant emphasis on bioenergy and bioproducts. We have a very strong and historically strong program in solar research at the University of Minnesota, and we continue to make significant investments there, both solar thermal for heating and cooling, as well as photovoltaic, and more recently concentrated solar. We haven't historically had as much effort on wind, geothermal, or hydropower, although we recently got a significant award from the Department of Energy on wind research, so that is ramping up. And we must spend more time, in my opinion, on what I frequently refer to as the other side of the equation, that is conservation and efficient energy utilization. And one of the things that is unique about this program at the University of Minnesota is this cross-cutting or undergirding, if you will, set of issues on policy, economics, and ecosystems. So that as we develop a new solar technology or a new biomass conversion technology or some new approach to wind technology, we concurrently want to have, and ideally on that team, have researchers who bring the perspectives of policy, economic benefit or impact, as well as ecosystem services. Within this broad portfolio, we've targeted some areas provisionally for some additional investments. Those are highlighted. I mentioned algae already. Catalysis, that is the conversion of these biomass materials to something useful, either thermochemically or biologically, is something we have significant strengths in and want to capitalize on. And, you know, early on in the development of IRE, this new director had met with a journalist. And I apparently said, because she put it right there in her article, why biomass? I said, well, we grow a lot of stuff here. Well, the fact is we do grow a lot of stuff here. And next generation feedstocks, Don mentioned some of that in the case, for example, of hybrid poplar, are something we continue to focus on. I mentioned solar thermal in this next generation life cycle analysis and, of course, our educational curriculum. Mr. Chair, I'm going to seek your guidance here. I have a few more slides just to highlight a few examples, or I'd be happy to have questions, or I'd be happy to stop.
Well, we've, you know, I've got a few questions for you because I got a kind of an interesting question. You know, you're doing a lot on, it seems, of similar type things that the NRI is doing. And so you're both doing studies on biofuels and, you know, powering furnaces or electrical generating plants or whatever with that. So we put some type of system in at the University of Minnesota Morris, and it doesn't work. And it hasn't worked. And you're both doing the research, and you're part of the same university. How does Morris buy a furnace to heat their entire campus? It's going to be using corn stover, I think, corn stock, whatever it uses, mm-hmm. that doesn't work right, and yet both of you are doing research on how to use biofuels and put it in a furnace so it works right. And you're all the same University of Minnesota. So maybe either of you, Dick or Don, can answer that question.
Well, since puzzles. I'll just leap to the floor, I'll let him start, and then I'll try to respond as well, Mr. Chair.
There's a couple things I think they're important. One of the things that I had mentioned that, and by the way, we are receiving IRE funds for the hybrid poplar program, for some other smaller grants that we have as well. So some of our people are participating with their colleagues across the campus, the different campuses. But in the case of Morris, though, what they ran into is a energy density problem. They tried to take the corn stover directly and found that it wasn't dense enough to basically be used as a primary fuel for that process. So we're now working with them actually to consolidate that material at our Coleraine laboratory. In fact, there'll be some tests coming in the next 3 weeks where we're actually going ahead and briquetting and densifying that material so they have more energy content per volume of feed so that they can make that process work. What they found is that if they were able to densify the material and put more fuel value in there, they think they can make the gasifier down there work.
But the
so
point,
we're trying to aid them
but
on
the
that.
Point being, they're the University of Minnesota. They bought a boiler facility that was supposed to heat their campus. You guys are doing all that research. How do they end up buying something that doesn't work? I don't understand it. When you got
the problem, smart,
somebody evidently something was dense enough, and it was somebody that ordered the boiler.
Well, as we've, so, we've learned from, you know, the vice chancellor down there, what they bought was a system that was designed that had utilized a more woody type of product, and they wanted to then apply it to the use of some of these agricultural products, which have less density. So now
Don, my point being to the two of you here that are running.
We didn't have some of that data at the time.
But the point is, why didn't the University of Minnesota, when the university now put in somewhere, I saw that they're going to be putting a windmill at, what's the place, Umore?
Umore.
Did they come to you, Dick, and ask you for advice, or did they just decide?
It's money.
Yeah, that they're going to put a windmill.
In the case of the gasifier at Morris, one of the challenges, frankly, is that one and many of these other biomass conversion systems in a commercial sense are serial number one. Yeah. That's literally where the development of some of these new renewable energy systems is at. So that's just the reality at that particular gas fire. In that particular case, getting a system small enough at the scale that would fit into the system at the University of Morris was another challenge. It's easier to find commercially viable, much larger systems, and that speaks to one of the real challenges with biomass, bioenergy conversion, biopower, is scaling these systems down. Engineering-wise, we have spent decades scaling up in terms of scale. For a couple of reasons, in the case of biomass, we now have to go the other direction. In fact, that's a significant part of our efforts is conversion systems that are smaller. A, because the needs and the availability of biomass and the proximity of the biomass are going to drive us to smaller and smaller systems. And the industry simply hasn't yet progressed to the point of having, if you will, off-the-shelf devices ready to use. And well, that's what
maybe I'm not making myself clear here.
Well, no, I think you're making yourself
University
very clear.
Minnesota,
I just don't have a good response to your question.
The University of Minnesota Twin City campus, all wanting to accomplish the same thing. Did Morris call either of you and say, we're thinking of putting this in, help us?
Not only did they call us, Mr. Chair, but Andrew, I will admit that IRE has invested some of our resources in that system because we needed to do the research to find out how to make it work. In the interest of full disclosure.
And I can also
good. I'm glad to hear you're at least cooperating a little bit because I was puzzled by it.
Smiling over there and laughing now.
Mr. Chairman, I can also ahead. Say that the Morris campus did contact us because we have a smaller gasifier that we can also utilize to help characterize some of the issues associated even with their larger gasifier. And we're, in fact, working with them now with that gasifier and with this consolidation work to help them come up with a fuel that they can use in their facility.
In that system. Before I forget, can we both, from both of you, get for the committee a source of where your money comes from, what federal monies and other grants you have gotten because of the money you've
certainly
gotten.
Certainly, as I said, the seed money.
Hold on a second. And then where it has gone, whether it's gone out in grants or to match other grant money or where it's gone. Representative Donald.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Just wasn't smiling. Maybe those were tears you were just seeing coming into my eyes. But these are, I think, just specific pieces of evidence. So we have real opportunity for consolidation and efficiency and optimization, I think, in both the MNSCU and the university system. And as we think about their budget challenges coming up, I think these kind of organizational consolidation opportunities would be something we really need to put on the table.
Well, and you bring up a good point, but I think, you know, Mr. Hemmingson's directive now has expanded, and you saw all that chart where we got everybody almost at the university involved, whereas I think the NRI is looking specifically at applied research. That was their goal, to use our natural resources, which, you know, maybe Dick has also some examples of what he's done to jump from basic research to applied. But
yeah, I mean, let's just continue on the biomass conversion theme for a moment. I mean, we have, for example, on the more applied scale, a number of projects that we funded. For example, the Chippewa Valley Ethanol Co-op, CVAC, at Benson, is currently using, and if their permit is fully authorized, will add a second gasifier with the goal of reducing replacing about 93% of their natural gas use from biomass. Well, what does that have to do with IRE? We worked with our colleagues out at the West Central Research Outreach Center in Morris and the ARS, Agricultural Research Service in Morris, and the folks at Chippewa Valley to look at both the densification strategies of this biomass, whether it's palleting or logs or what have you, as well as something that Mr. Posnack mentioned, a real challenge in this biomass are the logistics of where do you grow it, how do you get it, how do you harvest it, how do you develop that kind of an infrastructure to deliver? And so that's an example of a project in the biomass area that involved a number of different partners. In the case of solar, just as another quick example, a number of our projects, in particular the solar photovoltaic, have some industrial partners, and another solar thermal one worked with a major home builder in terms of redesigning the roof and truss system of new residential homes to incorporate renewable energy systems. So there's a number of examples in that front, and those are just a couple.
Representative Hollis put his solar panels on the north side of his house because he heard I was going to turn the state around. So
is that right?
Yeah. Anyway, are there any other questions? Any other questions, Mr. Hemmingson? Representative Clark.
I have one question. In the beginning, when you were making the distinction between the two parts of the organization, IRE and the ION, so there isn't really much in here about ION, but I did go online to look at it. And you mentioned that they do some stuff with food production. Is that part of, I couldn't really find it.
Well, you know, the particular emphasis of the Institute on the Environment with respect to food is, you know, there's a real, as you know, all of us know, a real challenge in terms of how are we going to feed 9, give or take, billion people on this globe with the existing amount of land in terms of providing food, fiber, and now energy needs, and do it in a sustainable manner. So the Institute on the Environment isn't focused as much on, let's say, the agronomy and the plant pathology of the production of food in that sense, but really looking at more of the systems approaches to how are we going to produce that amount of food, feed, and fiber for that kind of a growing population on a sustainable basis. And so there are still very active colleges and departments, as is the case with IRE, where the work is done at NRI and the departments and the colleges, and we try to facilitate the kind of the consolidation of those efforts. And so I'm not sure that fully answers your question. I should mention, Mr. Chair, and I know time is short, I'd be more than happy to meet individually with any or all of you to talk more about this, and feel free to take advantage of that if you'd be interested.
Representative Eastland, and we're going to.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I guess just kind of a question for NRI. A lot of your the projects you talked about, things you talked about, were working with in partnership with some other entity, a small business. Is in the numbers when you give the numbers of where your income comes from or how much money, could you give us some kind of an idea about how much money you leverage from the private sector as well in that process?
Yeah, I think kind of numbers, Mike.
I had a chart up. We generally get about.
Mike, why don't you come up forward?
Can you find it?
But Representative Eastland is asking a good question, and I guess we don't need an explanation now. But what we do when you give the numbers, would you show what private sector leverage leverages from you too? And Dick, the same with you when you get those numbers back.
Exactly. A couple ways of looking at that. Probably about
4 out of 16.
Yeah, maybe about, I think right now we've probably got about $3 million a year coming in from the state as a state special, about $3 million a year coming in from industry sources, probably an equivalent amount coming in from federal sources. So I would say about 25% would be private sector, but I ran through it, but I think one of the things you got to understand is that when we're working with the private sector, we begin on the bench scale, then we might start small pilot scale. Eventually we end up in their plant, in their shop, and in some cases they put in significant external dollars that don't come through my budget that I can't track. So it can be a lot. I can tell you that a couple projects in the last 7 or 8 years have contributed over $60 million of external industry funds on our projects on our behalf, and it never comes through our budget.
Well, we can get those materials from
get to the
both
numbers.
Of your
organizations. You look at the my colleague put up our funding at the current level right now. In last fall, for example, we had $3 million from state special. We have some operating money that was our state base, indirect cost recovery, some other state projects, permanent university funds. That's minerals, and that combines the permanent university fund and the chaired position, which is jointly sponsored by industry. The federal, a few years ago we were at $6 million, but in this time we're down to $2.3 million. Industry was at $2.7 million. and a small amount of foundation, and we were operating last fall at about 13.4. It's on the way up a little bit now. It's like that's the way it is.
And you can get us a breakdown of where it came from and where it goes.
Oh, yeah.
Okay. Thank all of you for coming, and the meeting is adjourned.